Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's episode, this special interview with my friend Jules Thorpe, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends, and welcome back. I'm very happy you're here today. And today's episode is special. I've done a couple of interviews in the past, and those have been received really well by you guys. And I think it's just very important to hear from other perspectives and have people tell stories, especially in situations like this where I don't know very much about these cases. And Jules has done so much work on the cases that we're going to be discussing today. And I just want to spread the word about them. I know listeners sometimes ask me like how they can be of service, any way that they can help. And that's by listening and amplifying these stories. So I want to welcome Jules Thorpe from FireEyes Media, my friend.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me again, Kadra. I always love coming on your show.
Yes, it's always wonderful. And I've told you stories and we've discussed true crime cases I've dove deep into. But today, Jules is going to be telling me some stories, some very important stories.
I'm going to share specifically two different cases that I've been diving deep into the last 2 years, actually, and take you a little bit along that process and that journey and what that looks like on my side as the investigative podcaster and trying to figure out how to become a family advocate and tell this story ethically, but sustain it so it's entertaining so people actually care. It's all very interwoven, kind of juggling act at times.
Yeah, I can only imagine. You spend countless hours doing research, I can tell, and like looking over police reports, records, and I think working directly with the families is so incredibly important when we're trying to tell the story correctly. I just really appreciate everything that you're doing, and I'm fascinated by it. And yeah, I would just love for us to shed some light on these cases. So I know recently you shared the story of Bethany Markowski on season 2 of Missing in Hushtown. And I want my listeners to hear about Bethany.
Absolutely. So if you're unfamiliar with Bethany Leanne Markowski, she was 11 years old, March 4th, 2001, when she went missing. She was in the custody of her father at the time, court-ordered unsupervised visitation. So her parents, Larry and Johnny, were in a very contentious divorce settlement. So this was only the second unsupervised visitation that Bethany was under with her father for the weekend. The first one went okay. The second one, she didn't want to go. She told her mom, "I don't want to go. What if he doesn't bring me back?" And her mom said, "Honey, he has to bring you back because if he doesn't, he's breaking the law and I will find you." And that has haunted her mother, Johnny, for decades. Now, the last words that she spoke to her daughter were, "I love you." The story goes like this, that Larry Markowski, Bethany's father, took her to a shopping mall, allegedly. This is according to her father, Jackson, Tennessee, the Old Hickory shopping mall. And he took a nap in his van, allowed 11-year-old Bethany Markowski to go into the mall alone. But upon awaking from his nap, she has still not returned from inside the mall. And so he allegedly goes into the mall, looks for her, cannot find her. Well, it's a Sunday. The mall's about to close. So a security guard says, "You need to call the police because the mall's about to close. You need some more help here." So they call the police. Come to find out, Bethany was never seen on any of the mall footage, entering or exiting the mall that day at all. Now, her father, Larry, is seen but Bethany is not seen. There has been zero confirmed reports or communications of Bethany since her disappearance. It is our belief on this side of things that Bethany actually never made it to the shopping mall. And throughout the last few years working on this case, there's four women podcasters and producers that do it. I have my team, Fire Eyes Media, my co-founder, Jen Rivera, and then we have our co-producers, the Amazing Momcast women from Like Mother, Like Murder podcast. Some of you might know. They do a weekly podcast, but I'm so impressed with their investigation skills, their dedication, and their ethics that I invited them to, well, told them. I really needed them on this season. And Rachel Holloway and Heather Northcraft also did this. So the last 2 years, we've been diving super deep into this case. And it's taken us on many different paths. We've done a foot search ourselves based on tips and leads. I've been in contact with the FBI agent on the case. We work alongside the family. We won't do any long-form Hushtown podcasts without working with the family. So the family's the boss first and foremost because it's their story. And it's interesting, though, Kadra, because throughout all this, Larry Markowski has never really come forward. He's never searched for his daughter publicly. He's never gone to any of the vigils. Bethany's mom got March 4th, 2001, officially Tennessee Missing Children's Day. So March 4th in Tennessee is Missing Children's Day because of her daughter. But one thing we didn't see happening was actually was able to talk to Larry throughout the podcast, communicate through his current wife, and talk to him also directly on the phone. So it's been a very wild ride. And we take you through a lot of the twists and turns in the podcast. But one thing we don't do, Kadra, is we don't go into probably 35% of what I've been doing behind the scenes. As far as these rabbit holes I've been going down and these leads I've been taking and these tips I've been researching, because we were asked not to by law enforcement. So we did like a full stop, which is a good sign in a case. But so we stopped the season where we stopped it, which we do feel like it was a solid stop, but it's a pause for
okay.
now.
So basically, y'all had gotten to a really good spot of figuring things out where it wasn't ethically like, oh, we should publicly keep talking about this because...
Correct.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
A lot of the theories and deep dives and tips that we had come in would give the advantage to the wrong team.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it would release too much information that we had known. And would it have made an entertaining podcast? Yeah, of course it would have. But we're here to advocate first. If you're good at what you do, you can create an entertaining podcast without exploiting and hurting a case. And if you can't, then you need to get out, because that's not what we're doing here.
Absolutely. I've seen other podcasts highlight Bethany's case, but I don't know if I've seen one that has done such a deep dive on it and worked so closely with the family. What was that process like, contacting the family, hearing their perspectives? I've worked briefly with families some, but you do it so often and for so long. I'm very curious what that process was like.
It's very all-consuming. I think in the best way too. I always say, like, we go out to try to help families of missing people, and we find pieces of ourselves along the way, because they teach us so much about resilience and courage and strength and grit and tenacity and boundaries. With Bethany's case, I found Bethany through the first season of Missing in Hushtown about Jennifer and Adriana Wicks. The moms had communicated with each other over the last few decades because our towns are just about an hour apart. And so they had very similar events they would go to of mothers of missing children and things like that. And they would email each other. And I saw those emails and it was so powerful. When we were looking for season two of Missing in Hushtown, I knew about Bethany because of the Facebook page, was interacting with us on Facebook and with Jennifer and Adriana Wicks' page on Facebook. So when I brought it to Jen, we had been asked to take on a few different cases for season two. It's really hard because you can't take them all on. We had a local case, a family approach us, their lawyer, and asked if we would take it on. For some reason, it just didn't feel right. And Bethany's felt right. And we waited on it and we thought about it. We prayed about it. We're like, we have to do Bethany's story. So I approached her mom, and she had known who I was through the work with the Wicks girls. And she agreed to let us in. We've spoken probably almost every week the last few years since then. We'll call each other, text each other, and anything that we do goes through her as well. We actually also, you know, with our families, I don't know if other people do this, we have a contract that they sign. And the main reason for the contract is to protect them. So in the wording, it's my husband's a life flight pilot. And so I got this from him, where there's a medical pilot, and then there's a paramedic, and there's a nurse. And there's so there's three people on board. And if one of them is uncomfortable going up in the air on a call, you don't go. So it's three yeses to go, one to say no. So if not everybody's on board, we don't do it. And so that's what we give the families, the protection, that family advocate or the family member that is in the contract with us. If you say no about this episode, it doesn't go. It gives them the final say, and it protects them as well. And also it stipulates in there, we give 10% of anything we might ever make from that specific podcast back to their foundation. But I think that's something that I'd like to encourage other podcasts to do, is to put the power in the family of their story, because there's a lot of unethical dealings out there. I always want to do more, and I'm sure our families will say they have to pull me back, because I'll get fired up and be like, let's get them. when they say down, I'm like, yes, ma'am, calm down. But I'm also under the belief, you got to go, 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 go. Although this has been an unsolved case for decades, I like to approach it and treat it as if it happened yesterday. We're about to enter the first 48 hours. And we often start from scratch. The number of times I've thrown out anything I've looked at, put it in the corner of the room, and started from scratch, because I didn't want to get too into my own bias or too into my own theories, is insane. It's obsessive, but it's a good obsession.
Well, I've heard that from other investigators as well, who have had a history of being a police officer, a detective, and gone into podcasting. Like Derek from Crime Weekly comes to mind, because I've listened to quite a bit of his stuff, where he's talked about there have been times that he's looked at quote unquote cold cases and totally started from scratch. And I think that's very important, is trying to see it from every angle, because human bias is such a normal thing and happens so much in these stories. And so you have to try to look past that. I'm also curious about Bethany. I would love to just hear about her, who this 11-year-old girl was.
She had just turned 11, and right before she went missing, and she was this vibrant, spunky, opinionated, very sweet, very kind, sassy girl, and she wasn't going to let just things slide. Very close with her family, very close with her mother. Later on, after her mother, Johnny and Bethany fled from the father in January of 2001, they went to live with her cousins, and she got really close with her cousins then. And so her cousins to this day are part of the fight to try to find her. Bethany loved to draw. She was creative, and she was just kind of like this spunky light, but not one that would you'd be able to walk all over. Like, you could tell from everything that we've learned that this girl would go on and make changes, make waves in whatever she was going to do. She was a strong force. And I think that makes it even harder, obviously, for anyone that's gotten to know Bethany throughout all this, is because what could she have accomplished? But also we look at it too, like Bethany's legacy, what she's accomplished, just her short 11 years of confirmed life, the last few decades of her missing, her legacy has gone on to help hundreds of missing children. Her mother works with the National Center of Exploited and Missing Children throughout the years in Tennessee Missing Children's Day, advocating. In a way, Bethany has changed and been a force, whether she was physically here or not. So I don't think there is any really stopping her purpose. And stuff. I think her favorite color was lime green. So you'll see like that lime green whenever we do our marketing stuff, which just totally embodies Bethany's just personality, vibrant and outgoing.
Did she have siblings?
She did. So she has two sisters and a brother. So her dad had two children before he was with Bethany's mother, Jenny and Daniel. And then her mom, Emily, had Emily before Bethany. So she had three older siblings, and she was the baby.
Okay. Oh, and
Yeah.
so there was clearly a lot of tension with the parents, and you said they had separated.
Yeah, so Larry Markowski was physically and verbally abusive
Okay.
to Johnny, like beat the crap out of her,
Okay.
in her
Okay.
own words, according to Johnny. And also on the podcast for the first time, we have Larry's ex-wives
Oh,
talk to each
wow.
other for the very
Okay.
first time in one of our episodes. And they
Okay.
talk, and they've never actually sat down and shared about stuff ever. And we share that when Johnny met Larry, he told her that he was divorcing and that his wife was gone and took the kids, and all that was untrue. It's wild. They go into how he broke his first wife's nose. He would beat them, sexually assault them, according to the reports of it. And so for the first time they sit down, they talk together about it. But the households, it was very contentious. And that's why Johnny decided to ultimately flee, is because as Bethany was getting older, she noticed that Larry was beginning to turn his behaviors towards Bethany. And so she took Bethany one day, took her out of school, and fled.
Okay. Yeah, that's one of the things I was wondering about, is if there had been any known instances of Larry being abusive or having any troublesome behavior towards the children or towards Bethany.
Yes, he did. And in the podcast, his oldest daughter, Jenny, relays to us a situation, which she was very brave to share. And then we also share about how he has physically harmed his son. It's very sad. It's very upsetting. I've met all of them, all the siblings. They're absolutely amazing and wonderful. And they all just want their sister brought home,
Right.
is what they want. Now, it's devastating because Johnny fled with Bethany, took her out of school and fled. And they drove from Gleason, Tennessee over to Jackson, Tennessee, and they parked the car and they left it in the parking lot. Johnny's sister and her husband came to get them and take them into Nashville. Johnny just left the car there. It's like, whatever, just leave it. I need to flee. Well, the same location where she dropped the car off was in that Jackson Old Hickory shopping mall parking lot. The same parking lot Larry says Bethany disappeared from. So how does it go? Like 8.5 weeks later, it just happens to be the same
Right.
exact spot. Do you believe in coincidences? I don't know, but everything from what I've learned is that it's calculated spite. Hope we're not correct. We hope that he's just some asshole, narcissistic man, and that's why he acts this way. But I think that likelihood is, I don't know, he knows more than he's letting on. And unfortunately, none of the wives, even his current wife, shared with me abuse. That's an unlikely relationship that I developed throughout all this that the other podcasts haven't been able to do. She talked to me throughout this entire thing, and I straight up ask her questions. And then she'd ask Larry, and then he'd tell her, and then she'd tell me, which was funny because he was like, I'm not going to talk on your podcast. But then he did. Through her. So we're like, let's go. And we genuinely became a genuine concern for her as well.
Yeah.
And she started talking to Johnny, and that was an unlikely relationship. It's all outlaid in the podcast, but it's very bizarre because we find ourselves so inserted into the story that we can't be unbiased, like the journalistic integrity of being unbiased in your stories, because we become part of it, which I think has some advantages too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I know it's going to be outlined in much more detail in the episodes, but could you give listeners an overview of what the investigation, like the initial investigation with the police, looked like for Bethany's disappearance?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the biggest shortcomings is that in Jackson, Tennessee, at the time, there were very few missing children cases in 2001. I think there may have been one from around that mall area. So they were not well versed in that at all. Now, when they approach the shopping mall at that evening when Bethany's reported missing, they can't search Larry's van because they don't have a search warrant. All they have, from what they know, is a father whose daughter is missing. That's all they know. Then it goes to the Jackson Police Department. They're working it. 9 days into the investigation, they contact the TBI, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, to run a background check, I believe, or a phone records check on Larry Markowski. Now, the TBI says, why? What do you need this for? We have a missing child. They said, well, you have a missing child. That should have been reported to us immediately. So we have this huge 9-day gap from when Bethany goes missing to when the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation is informed.
Wow.
Within those 9 days, Larry has gone to his sister's house, stayed with his sister, brought the van over. He's had 9 days to do anything he needed to do with the van. Now, after those 9 days is when TBI goes immediately and collects any evidence from inside the van. But we know what could happen within those 9 days. They did take, I believe, a pillowcase and a blanket. There was a drop of blood. When asked about it, Larry said that Bethany sat on a thorn. And there are conflicting reports that van was shampooed in the interim. I haven't been able to have a consistent answer because it is considered an open case. But I asked Larry about it through his wife, and she told me that no, the van was shampooed when he got it, not when Bethany went missing. Now, he got it a few months or weeks, it was very short before Bethany went missing, and then he sold it fairly quickly after, which a la carte, I know, seems very suspicious. But I will give him this. He was always selling and buying cars. That was his way to flip money. So when you look at it holistically, it's actually not as bizarre. But just through the lens of this case, like that's still weird. Two things could be true. He could have, done that and for nefarious reasons too.
So was any investigation ever done further against Larry or other suspects, other leads?
They did a lie detector test. Larry failed. Bethany's mom, Johnny, passed and got an award for most truthful lie detector test. The only she failed one question. They said, "Have you ever lied to anybody in your family the last like 6 months or whatever?" And she said no, and then she started bawling, and they stopped it, and she explained she told Bethany that she would come home. And she says she didn't know she lied to her daughter, but she promised her daughter she would come get her, and she didn't. And they turned it back on and redid the test or that part, and she obviously passed. And they said this is likely the most truthful lie detector test we've ever given. Larry has never been officially named a suspect. Unfortunately, none of the wives have ever filed a police report against him.
Yeah, I was curious about that as well with all the alleged abuse.
Yeah, and Larry has picked women who have had very traumatic, abusive pasts as well. They're actually very similar in their upbringings and their pasts. It's devastating the lens in which they had looked at themselves at the time of what they should accept and could accept or what they could do without him was very different. And I think he's quite predatory as far as those type of people that he goes after. Now, one thing that I want to tell everybody too is Larry was a truck driver, a long haul trucking driver. During this investigation, Larry goes back and starts trucking again. And during this time, Johnny is the one who was fighting to find her daughter. Larry then soon moves away from the town where they were living, goes to the opposite side of the state. It's all very bizarre and it all makes you scratch your head and bang your head against the wall and go, dude. Like, what else do you need here? I will say we talked to the former captain of the unit that first covered Bethany's disappearance from the Jackson PD, Officer Mike Holt, very nice man. And we asked him specific questions. There was a shovel found in a graveyard at the shopping mall where Bethany allegedly disappeared from, where the car was parked, where Larry said he was parked, in the back of the shopping mall. If you're not from these kind of areas in this country, you might not be familiar with random cemeteries in random spots. I know here in the South, it's very common to have a family cemetery or an old church cemetery and then have like a shopping mall or a strip mall around it. You can't bulldoze those. I mean, we have some graveyards in my property here. And anyway, so the car was parked over there. Well, police did find a shovel. It looked like a new shovel purchased from Walmart. And so they went and looked around the different Walmarts and saw some security footage of what looked like it could have been Larry purchasing a shovel. No confirmation on that. But I did ask Mr. Holt, where's the shovel now? Because this was 20 plus years ago.
Right.
He said, it should be in evidence. It should be, or it is. It should be. I said, well, who would be responsible for that? He said, the TBI. It's now with the FBI. They're all working together. And I said, well, can you retest it? I don't know. That's a them question. I'm like, okay. So we brought that point up. And I will say that I think more stuff is happening now. And that's a really good thing for Bethany. Because what we have so far, what I share is we have a shovel. Because I said, well, what about the dirt on the shovel? Where was that dirt? What about the fingerprints? Yada, yada. What about the pillowcase and the blanket that had the blood spot on it? What can we find about that? So I'm hoping they go back and retest everything.
Yeah, that would be amazing. That's like sometimes with cases, I think even ones that we had talked about before, where it's like, if we could just retest this evidence, that could be the answer to piece everything together.
Yep.
It gets complicated, though, when multiple groups are involved. Like when you have, oh, this is over at the FBI, the TBI has this, oh, I don't know. And like so much time has passed, it's gone through so many hands.
It has. And it's interesting because they're working together, I think, a lot more closely now. I think Jackson PD kind of got their hands taken out of it fairly quickly when it got passed on to the TBI. So I will give like the TBI, once they knew, they went forward with it. I was able to read all the correspondence. And this is some of the stuff we were going to share on the podcast, but between the TBI agent at the time and Johnny, I mean, it takes us through years and years of their correspondence and their investigation, but we've had to table that. But what I saw was, we're not the only ones who get overly, like you said, invested. I mean, I saw some lines that were like, are those crossing? Are those blurred? It's just because the agents care so much, and we can't remove human condition from what we're doing. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't be agents because they care. But I did read some emails where I was like, oh my gosh, this agent is needing to pull back a little bit too. But I'm like, am I talking to myself really?
Right.
I get it. It's especially when you really connect with someone, it's hard. I know that they cared and they really wanted to find Bethany. I think they thought that they would. There were a few sightings of allegedly of Bethany. There's a woman who tried to enroll a little girl in school in Eastern Tennessee, and a police sketch was made. And this police sketch looks a lot like Bethany's aunt, Carol Markowski, who's now deceased. She was married to her father's brother. And this sketch was also circulated in saying that the same woman took a little girl to a bus stop a few weeks after that. But it's not the same woman. What they did is they used the police sketch from the alleged school enrollment. And then people said, oh, I think that's the woman from the bus stop too. So we don't know if it actually is the same person, but it looks just like the picture of her aunt, Carol Markowski.
Wow.
Yeah. And to further make people believe that it was Bethany and Carol is that the lady who tried to enroll Bethany in school said, I actually don't have any of her information, her birth certificate or paperwork. Her father, I'm just her aunt. Her father's going to have to come back and do that. And so after that, they were like, what? That's got to be her. That's got to be her. I did a massive deep dive into this woman, Carol. She had a lot of problems throughout her life. I don't like saying mental problems, but I don't know what the right term would be. It would be
just troubled.
Troubled difficulties, some bad cards dealt, some bad choices made, consequences. And I have not ruled out that she may have been involved at the time. Unfortunately, she is deceased, though.
Okay. So to clarify, no one has ever been named a suspect in Bethany's disappearance. I also want to clarify, because there have been, you and I have talked about it, some harmful things that have been circulated online, some fake videos about Bethany being found. Could you speak on that?
Yeah, it's AI. AI can be a great tool in so many ways, but it's also, it's such a tool for people to take advantage. What we discovered was on YouTube, there are different accounts that are making a lot of money with hundreds and thousands of subscribers who are, according to what I've decided taking podcasts that are out there, long form podcasts, and feeding it into AI and rewriting it. And then not just rewriting it, but they're rewriting the ending. And so it's getting circulated on the internet and they're making money from each listen, each play. And Johnny had to listen. She saw it and she listened to this podcast say that Bethany came home. And she had a reunion with her mother, Johnny. And they rewrote the ending that she's alive and she's out there. That's harmful in so many ways. You're re-victimizing the family. And two, if you're telling everybody she's found, then people aren't going to look for her.
It's enraging.
It is enraging. And you cannot convince me it's 100% to make money. And that's the only thing that's out there. And the sad part is they're making probably so much money. We're not making money. And even if we did make money, 10% is always going back to the Bethany Markowski Foundation, which is now an official 501c by Bethany's family to help find missing children. It's so harmful.
And for people listening, I'll be sure to link that in the show notes.
Bethany Markowski Foundation, they just became official. They're doing incredible things. Johnny, for years, has been promoting fingerprinting kits for kids because Bethany was never fingerprinted. And so one thing that, if you're not aware, that kidnappers will do are traffickers, especially with runaways. They'll take the runaways and then the runaways can get fingerprinted and you can become anybody you know. So those fingerprints in the system, instead of like, say, Bethany Markowski, it could say Elizabeth Smith. So anywhere in life, those fingerprints could come up as Elizabeth Smith. There's no way to know it was actually Bethany because she had never had her fingerprints done.
Wow. And so they're working to change that.
They are. I took my boys. I have two boys at Tennessee Missing Children's Day we went to this year, and they got their fingerprints done. So I have their kits. They also say things as far as take a few strands of their hair from the root and put in a little baggie.
Okay.
And have something in there. And because when a child goes missing, you know, a lot of times all you have is a photograph. So you can't trace them. But if you get their fingerprints done and then you submit it and it goes into a system, maybe in 15 years, hopefully it's not that long, but there could be a little chance, a little sliver of hope there.
Wow. Yeah. So where does Bethany's case stand now?
I think it's moving and grooving. I actually just got back from a convention in New Mexico, Beyond the Crime Convention in Albuquerque, and Johnny and Jen and I did a panel on stage about Bethany, and Johnny did share that they're going back and retesting a bunch of evidence. I have known that for a while, but couldn't, you know, share it. But since she's put it out there, we can share it now. So you're the first one beside the convention that knows that.
Okay.
So I think it's moving. It's going in a good direction. We did get some tips and leads through our work, which led us to form our own search team. And I think, too, that reignited a lot of fire in people to
yes.
believe that they could get things going. And it started a lot of conversations, too, in the town again. You have all these people show up with cadaver dogs and bright orange vests, and it's a small town, and they see, what are you looking for? What are you doing? And people start to get to talking, and that's what you want. You want the conversation to continue to go. So boots on the ground. I mean, I'd probably be out there every weekend searching if I wasn't rained back, which is probably a good thing, because I can't continue to miss out on my family's life while I'm looking for other missing people. And that's kind of real talk. The boundary, which gets hard when you work with these long form cases, is you have to learn to be present with those with you, or you're going to miss out on the actual events happening around you too, you know?
Right. It's incredibly important. And I'm sure that balance can be really tough sometimes, because like you said, the lines understandably get blurred. I remember watching the videos that you were posting and sending us in our group chats about the foot search, and I was just blown away. I've never been a part of anything like that. I'm sure that was a wild experience.
It was. I have done a search and rescue team before. Our friend, a couple decades ago when I was a lot younger, went missing in his helicopter. So we did a foot search and a water search, and I'd actually forgotten about that. And so when we got the tip and we thought, well, we gotta go look, and I've never done this before. And I'm like, wait, I think I've done this before. So you kind of put things out of your mind when it's traumatizing. But Jason Landry, a young man missing out of Texas, his whole team, they have a Jason Landry volunteer search team, and they work diligently and they are just dogging in the search to bring Jason home. And I met them at CrimeCon 2 years in a row, and then I asked them to train us, and they trained us. And they taught me how to use the apps. And then we looked at how to do everything safely. And we formed this whole professional style team. We found some things along the way that weren't, I mean, we found teeth, but they were deer teeth. But at first, when you see things, that's a little jarring. And one of the things you have to be prepared for is when you're out searching for someone's loved one, you might find someone else's loved one. And so we wanted to make sure that we did this by the book. Professionally, we had law enforcement. So the FBI actually supported us in doing the search. They weren't able to go and assist us, but they supported our efforts in it and were able to talk to the place where we went to. And so that was great. That was supportive. But it was heavy. You're searching next in a line next to Bethany's family members, and you're looking for a bone.
Well, I am happy to hear that the case seems to be moving. For people who are listening to this, how can they find Missing in Hushtown? How can they support and like learn more about Bethany's story?
Yeah, we have Missing in Hushtown. It's season two. So if you go and look wherever you get your podcast, Spotify, Apple, wherever you listen, just search Missing in Hushtown and it'll be the second season. And you can tell the difference because it's a different. The season one has about 12 episodes about Jennifer and Adriana Wicks. And then season two is all about Bethany Leanne Markowski. And we will be doing updates on those as we go on, because we end the season. I mean, I ended season one 2 years ago, and I'm still working with the family every week. We're still working with Bethany her family, I say Bethany, every week. So we're still doing it, and so it's more than just a podcast. The advocacy side is huge, and it's interesting, Kadra, because this week I had a thought. I'm like, if I just give up podcasting, I'd be okay, because I want to advocate and look at these stories. I think that's been part of the journey, is I started podcasting to podcast, and it's totally revealed to me that I'd rather advocate, be boots on the ground, and get into the story, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it makes sense because podcasting is such a huge umbrella. So it can take you through all these different avenues and make you realize what's really important, what you really want to do. In a way, this is an art form and it's a way to share stories, but it's much more intimate, I would imagine, to like actually be there with the families on the ground. So I think that's amazing. And I've said it before, but I'll say it again. You're always doing incredible work. And I'm very inspired. You work so hard, and I know it's probably like, oh, whatever, but you know, like what you're doing is so important, and I know these families appreciate it so much.
Thank you. It's definitely a team. It's a team effort. I've known enough to know to bring in people that are wiser, stronger, braver, more determined than me too, because they keep me going. So the girls with Momcast and Jen with FireEyes, they've been phenomenal team. It's been a dream.
It takes a village.
It does. It does. And I learned not to do it alone anymore. That's probably one of the biggest things.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. And when I spend 200 days a year rolling down the highway, the bus can start to feel smaller than a guitar case. Everyone wonders how I stay chill while the hours crawl by. Truth is, one good luck spent on Chumba, and suddenly the trip feels a whole lot shorter. Finding your space, even when there isn't much to spare. Need some chill? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
So let's pivot now because you've started working on a new podcast for Jeff Anderson, Secrets Beyond the Sacramento River. I listened to the first episode, and for everybody listening, I'll also put episode one onto my feed as well so that you guys can listen, but then go over to the podcast and listen as they release more episodes. But yes, Jules, can you tell us about Jeff Anderson?
Absolutely. The last 2 years we've been working on the Bethany case, I've also been working on Jeff's case. And it's been a bit of a slower burn. So Jeff's case, Jeff Anderson was 40 years old when he was pulled out from the bottom of the Sacramento River in the Delta. It's an area called the Delta area in Sacramento, California. He was inside. His car was in park. His keys were in his front pocket. And he was not buckled in. So right off the bat, there are some suspicious circumstances. But however, given that that is suspicious, how did his car get into the bottom of the river with his car in park, his keys in his pocket? There was no criminal investigation. There was really no adequate follow-up on anything that we have been able to find by the California Highway Patrol. So it was never a homicide investigation. So California Highway Patrol took the case, and then they would have to give it over to the Sacramento Sheriff to say, yeah, here's the case, further look into it for homicide, here's our findings. But that's not what they did. They found that Jeff died through a DUI because his autopsy showed that he had elevated alcohol blood in his system. And so that was what it was ruled, was that he drove off into the water. There's zero explanation for how his key was in his front pocket, why his car was in park, and why his cell phone also was never found. So his cell phone was never found. He had another phone, which was in his car, an old phone that no longer worked. Jeff was never without a cell phone. And it's interesting because we have data that shows that his cell phone shut off about 2 hours, hour and a half before he went into the water. And then it turned back on about 3 or 4 hours after he went in the water.
Oh.
And it traveled. And we have the known location of where it traveled to as well. And that's what we're trying to do, is go back and did this really travel? Was it a Google Maps mistake? Was it later? Did it get updated later? What are the answers to this? The biggest thing about this case is that nobody's really talking. And that's why we call it Secrets Beyond the Sacramento River. And it's sad because Jeff was a great guy. He has a family that loves him and they're deep in the depths of grief. This only happened September 9, 2023. So it's still fairly fresh. And when his sister, I call her Rebecca, when Rebecca approached me about this, I said, okay, how can I help you? What do you need? And then she needed more time. And she found me through Missing and Hushed Tan social media. And she needed more time. Okay, when you're ready, come to me and I'll help you. Well, after about a year, she came back and said, okay, I think I'm ready. But a lot of people aren't talking, and it's because there's conflicting reports. Some people say that allegedly Jeff was assaulted. So we take you along each step of the way of this journey of starting from the 911 calls, how dispatch changes the codes, how Jeff went into the water September 9, 2023. However, nobody went to the water to dive and look for him from law enforcement until 2 days later. And we just talk about the shoddy police work and how they failed Jeff, in our opinion. What we would like is for them to come forward and say, yeah, we screwed up. Let's start again. Let's follow these leads. So you say Jeff got assaulted at a bar a few hours before he goes into the water. Why did we not go to that bar and look at
surveillance? Yeah.
None of that was done. He went to two different establishments that day. Hey Tones, a cook-off in the afternoon, and then allegedly Tony's place. And neither place was approached to give any of their videos or anything. And that's a huge misstep. And I think one of the reasons that CHP, California Highway Patrol, told Rebecca was that there's no report made about an assault, so they wouldn't have gone to go check it out or anything. But she tells them within 24 hours of finding Jeff that she's getting reports that he was assaulted. When Jeff's body is pulled out from the bottom of the water, Jeff's dad visually sees what he says looks like his son has been assaulted. And we go into every part. It gets pretty shady. We had an interview with the tow truck driver who was the one who cranked Jeff's car out of the water. And he says there was a boulder in the driver's seat and it was inside the car. Well, how does that get in there if the windows were rolled up? The windshield was not cracked enough. You can get a boulder into the car. And then we don't have the photos. We don't have the autopsy photos. They didn't release that. They gave us the autopsy. We have all the incident reports. We have the call dispatch logs, not the call phone numbers. One thing on the log, which was baffling to us, is the fire chief is talking on the dispatch radio and says, I'm going to hang up and talk to you more about this on the landline. I talked to him and I said, hey, why did you do that? He said, well, there's a lot of ears listening on these calls, on the scanners. I'm like, well, duh. Like, that's for transparency. And he's like, yeah, it's just easier sometimes just to say what I want to say. I'm like, well, what did you want to say? He's like, it was 2-3 years ago. I don't know.
Yeah, that's very questionable. That definitely would leave me unsettled. I'm also curious with the autopsy report. So you have had a chance to look at that?
I have, and I'm not convinced that he was conscious when he went into the water. I think he was unconscious. And that is going off of the amount of foam in his airways and the amount of fluid retention in his lungs, which would indicate the level of being aware and breathing in that water. Now I know you can lose oxygen, fewer than a couple minutes when your car goes into the water. So either way they reacted that night and got him out or not, may not have saved his life, but it would have changed his autopsy report, because when you're in the water for X amount of days, that is going to drastically change everything. And one thing that they don't talk about too is the blood alcohol level. Yes, based off of that, it looks like he was drunk. He was also diabetic. And he wasn't on medication. And he's trying to do it on his own. And so when you take a diabetic and you add alcohol, that's not a great scenario. Now, we just got a tip recently this week. So we have two full episodes out right now for you to listen to wherever you get your podcasts. We've stopped for two more weeks because we got more tips and we've had to follow up, and it's all of a sudden, the case is like blowing up and people are coming forward after us doing this for so long. All of a sudden, people are talking, and that's awesome. Mm-hmm. But it's also making us stop and say, okay, well, we got to rewrite this. We got to figure this out.
Right.
I mean, we just got a tip that somebody saw Jeff being put into his car after one of the bars, that they were physically helping put him in his car. And okay, we are waiting on more information on that.
Okay.
There's a lot of suspicious things.
Did the autopsy report mention injuries on his body?
No, it didn't. It didn't mention any type of like contusions or any type of things that Jeff's father said he saw.
Right.
Which is interesting. I also don't have the photos. I have all of the images from when they took Jeff's car out. And I have the images of the car photos and when they turned, because it got pulled out upside down and then they turned it over. But I don't have any of the photos of Jeff at the crime scene. I say crime scene. Mm-hmm. I truly do believe there was something going on.
Right. Well, I mean, I could see why you would say that.
At the accident report, at the accident scene. But I don't have any photos of Jeff. And we tried to get the photos, the autopsy photos as well. And they didn't release those to the family. So I'm going back and I'm doing the California records request on our own, because what we did is we had the family get them all, but then they redact quite a bit. It's a frustrating thing. I mean, I've reached out to law enforcement multiple times, and like SAC Sheriff, I emailed them all the time, quite needy. And they'll say this was a CHP, California Highway Patrol case, and it was closed, and it was the coroner ruled it a drowning. Well, I don't know if everyone listening knows how cause of death sometimes is figured out, but the coroner knows what the situation was surrounding how they got to this point. So Jeff's brought in, okay, here's the incident report, here's this. He's found in his car. Okay, he's got some fluid. Okay, it's a drowning. But beyond that, it doesn't explain. Nobody has taken the time to investigate and explain why his key was in his front pocket, why his car was in park. And we dive into why witness statements that night who saw Jeff's car roll into the water changed more than three times. More than three times they've changed their story. It's all very shady, and it's enough to make you go, huh? Why was there not an investigation? Somebody needs to answer to the family for that, because I truly feel that the family was failed. And in fact, Jeff's family, Jeff's sister, Rebecca, told me that one of the law enforcement officers said, I told you Jeff was on drugs, because the toxicology on the autopsy report allegedly showed that Jeff was on drugs. And then when they called the coroner to confirm the family, it was not true. He was not on drugs. And then the law enforcement then backpedaled and said, well, we were, must have been sent the wrong report or something. But they never apologized to the family, too.
What the hell?
Yeah, they never apologized to the family. And it's interesting because the witnesses, and I'm sorry I'm jumping around a bit, but the witnesses from that evening saw Jeff's car parked by their house at night.
Right.
And according to the witnesses, the car then, they see it roll into the water. They don't hear anyone. They don't see anyone in the car.
Yeah.
But they also told the fire chief, who told me that they said, we're sure someone's in there. We know someone's in there. We saw someone in there. And then they're telling other people, hey, there were two cars. One sped off as soon as Jeff's car started rolling down the water. The second car sped off. So now we're like, well, where the hell is the second car? And who was in there? And then why did your story change?
Yeah. What kind of car was it? Right.
Yeah. So we don't know much of that. So we're kind of, it's a different kind of case because we're kind of doing everything on our own.
Yeah.
Because we're the only ones that really are looking into it. But one thing we absolutely know with true crime podcasting is when one case gets out there enough, it starts catching on. And we just need enough people that aren't from that area, that aren't connected to that group, to see, yeah, this is not right. This is weird. Somebody needs to look into this. And so that's our point, is to raise awareness and get loud. And so we're taking this case. We've had conventions that we're signed up for all over the country and in England this year. So I'm taking it everywhere with me because I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah. The detail I can't get over is, how does a parked car end up in a river?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I've gone through so many rabbit holes here, Kadra. One of them is, okay, people panic when their car starts to go into water. They'll panic. They'll put their car in park, but they don't often put their keys in their front pocket. So if your car was rolling, you put it in park, then you shove your key in your pocket. And then according to the witnesses, the car was floating for about 3 or 4 minutes down the river before it went into the water. And there was no noise, no attempt to get out. So somebody would have to have been conscious to take the key out and then put it in their pocket.
Right.
I go through the forensics reports in one of the episodes we have coming up. One of the wheels of the car indicates that it was dragged, that there is the way that the tread marks are and the way that the mud is caked into one tire indicates that it did not turn and that it was like pushed.
Dragged. The car was dragged into the water?
Well, according to the car forensics report, one of the wheels indicates that it did not rotate, which could indicate that it was pushed or...
Right, like it's possible.
Or okay. Hit from behind, yeah.
Okay.
There's discrepancies as well. One of the reports say that the windows of Jeff's car were broken out when they retrieved the car. That's not true. I have the photos. So I don't know what they were smoking, but it's right. Not true.
And was there any damage on the car?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. There's damage. But here's the hard part, is the car was pulled out upside down, up a ravine.
Yeah.
The rocks and everything. So you don't know what's what. But the windows, divers went down and buoyed his car and flagged it. And they couldn't see in because the windows were up and it was too foggy, too gloomy. The water was just murky. The windows were up. And so if they're trying to say that then, you know, they brought it out and the windows were broken, but then I'm seeing the photos that they took while they're dragging his car out and they're not broken. Like, Yeah. Who is leading this? Nobody. This is shoddy work, and it's almost embarrassing. And I'm not one. I come from a law enforcement family and a first responder family.
Okay.
My husband's a first responder. My mom was a cop. My dad was a lawyer. I have a lot of respect for the good ones. A lot of people just suck at their job no matter what field. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this is an area where a lot of cars go into the water for insurance jobs. And there's a theory that there was a lack of urgency to get Jeff out because it was written off as an insurance job.
Mm.
That somebody just put the car in the water and then, you know, the car stolen, collect insurance, whatever. But either way, you had eyewitnesses saying, I just watched this car go in the water right here, right here. Well, wouldn't you know that the car, Jeff was found in his car less than 500 feet away from where the car entered the water.
Right.
Why did it take that long to find him? I don't.
Yeah, you guys talk about that in the first episode. So I think you had said it took 2 days to find the car and 4 days to find him.
Yeah. So September 9th, he goes in and it talks on dispatch how we're going to send the Marine sergeant there in the morning. So that would be September 10th when the daylight comes up. Nobody goes out there September 10th, as far as we know. September 11th, they go and buoy tag his car. September 13th, they pull him out.
Okay.
Because it's not until September 11th that he doesn't show up to work and the missing persons report is filed and people start to talk in the Delta area
mm-hmm.
because they're knowing now that Jeff has been missing. Now a missing persons report has been filed and people are connecting that there was a report, a car went in the water. Jeff mm-hmm. was driving a white car. And then it's then that they started putting things into motion.
Okay.
He's inside his car. All the windows are rolled up. And so unfortunately, then you have a 4 day window of his body exposed to the elements in the water for an mm-hmm. autopsy. And with toxicology, you know, they didn't do certain tests in toxicology. We just have the blood alcohol. And so a lot of the pretty little bow that they packaged this case on is done by assuming he's in his car, he's in the water, he has a higher blood alcohol level, he drowned. He veered off, drunk driving, veered off the road and went down into the water.
Was he found in the driver's side?
No.
Where was
so
he
his
found
car
in
was,
the car?
His car was upside down, and he was found. I believe his hips were facing the front of the car, and his torso was facing the back of the car.
Oh, okay.
But it was very obvious he was not buckled in.
Mm-hmm.
And I have all, you know, all of the photos from the forensics report. Also, we've combed through those for signs of distress. A lot of people, when they go into the water, there will be signs of them trying to claw out, trying to break out, using the headrest to slam. Those were intact. And also, that's assuming, okay, if two things could be true, he could have been intoxicated,
mm-hmm.
and this could have also been foul play.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he was not coherent enough to even call for help, Jeff was deathly afraid of water. He was deathly afraid of water. If he was conscious enough to go into the water and knowingly go into the water, he would have fought like hell from everything that we've heard to get out of the water. It was like a real known fear of his.
So the case at this moment is closed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's considered a closed case. And our whole point is saying there should have been an investigation. There wasn't even one.
Mm-hmm.
We want to know, why were his keys in his front pocket? Why was his car in park? Why did it take so long to get him? And why did the witness statements change so many times? And why is there a rumor that Jeff was beat up? And we know the name of the individual that everyone says beat him up. And everyone seems to be very afraid of him. And now we're getting different reports. And we also have the phone records that show his traveling much different than what people said. Also, people have tried to log into his social media accounts after Jeff died. It's sad. You know, I have all access to Jeff. I've seen every text message, every email, every keystroke he took. His sister, Rebecca, has given me full rein. And I will say, I think that something happened either by someone who didn't know him very well at one of the establishments, or people know something went wrong. They didn't mean for it to go wrong. And it was just a whole slew of things that went together and they're scared. But I think there's some responsible party out there who doesn't want to get in trouble and change the course of their life. And in doing so, they're ruining Jeff's family's life.
What do you think it would take for this case to be reopened?
I think it takes a podcast to get really popular, because the power of the internet and armchair detectives, I think for people to go in and listen to it and catch what we didn't catch, ask the questions we didn't ask, we need a think tank, because somebody needs to be held accountable. We continue to email Sacramento Sheriff Cooper about this case. Allegedly, he didn't know Jeff's keys were in his pocket. Yes, he did, if he had read the report. I know there's a lot of people that work for him that need to do that as well. But I think that it needs to become popular enough so that's a thorn in their side. So they think, okay, now we have to be accountable to this.
So people listening, obviously they can help by listening to the podcast, sharing the story. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that listeners can do to help?
Right now, we don't have a petition. We don't have a GoFundMe yet. What we're doing is we're sitting on the podcast and seeing how loud we can get, and then seeing the course of action that we can take. We have some pro bono lawyers that we're reaching out to see even if there is a case. One of the things that we're very aware of is Jeff was at two bars that day. And we don't know if a lot of people don't want to talk because they're afraid of getting sued for liability.
Right. If he was like overserved. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the family's not interested in doing that. If that's what happened, they just want to know if that's what happened. They don't want to sue anybody. They don't want anybody's money. So if that's what is contributing people to not listening or not talking, it's heartbreaking. But, you know, people will want to protect their livelihood. But yeah, we don't have those yet. We're going off of the cues of Rebecca, his sister, and the family. And right now, pretty much all that they can manage right now is episode by episode of the podcast. But we plan to help them in the next steps as we continue, as we continue on.
Okay. So listeners should definitely go check out the podcast and just stay tuned for updates, it sounds like.
Yeah, the next few episodes will be coming out within the next 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So you can listen to the first two right now. Help us out by sharing it, commenting, rating it, because that's how you get pushed up in the algorithm on the ears. But we've got a lot of people. It's crazy because, you know, you can see who views your stories on Instagram and on Facebook.
Right.
The shady individuals whose names continue to come up, that they were the ones that assaulted Jeff, and the name of an individual whose residence shows Jeff's cell phone ended up at after his death, continues to watch our stories. So, I mean, I'll post things just for him, like, yo, call us back.
Yeah.
Hey, hello. Where's his phone? Hello.
I see you.
So it's a very immersive experience. I'm very active on Facebook, Your Host Jules True Crime. Also Instagram, but Facebook, I post more case specific stuff on Facebook a lot. And then What Happened to Jeff Anderson is on Facebook and Instagram, and that's run by the family. I just want to say, if you're listening and you're at all curious or you think you can add anything, please do. Email me, Jules@fireeyesmedia.com. I spell it J-U-L-E-S, because we're not the smartest ones in the room. There are so many people listening, professionals, just armchair detectives, amateurs that are so brilliant that catch things that we need your help. Mm-hmm. We're pretty much just like the megaphone, but we need the think tank. And the way that podcasting is changing that, that's one of the really good outcomes, I think, of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're thinking, what about this? What about this? You can definitely email Jules. Anything else that you want to mention or plug?
No, I just want to thank you for allowing me to share about this, because these cases matter. These are real people. Bethany, whether she's alive or not, she's still out there.
Mm-hmm.
And just the fact that she's out there means that we won't stop. And it takes a lot from every party involved, but she's worth it. And so if you listen to Missing in Hushtown, or if I'm not your jam butter, then listen to any other of the ones, you know, about Bethany, except that AI one.
Please. Yeah, please don't.
But please, if you're curious about anything, look up the cases to yourselves, because we're not the end all be all. We're just, like I said, the megaphone. I want to thank you for caring and listening, because that's how people will get their babies home and justice for their brothers and hold people accountable who are supposed to be doing their jobs.
Yeah, it's all consuming sometimes because there's countless stories like this out there and it's hard to be aware of all of them. But anytime I have an opportunity to like learn and share, I always want to do that and amplify the voices of the families, the victims, and the people who are like working so hard who know so much about these cases. So I just appreciate you taking the time to tell me and my listeners about it. Because like I was telling you, I got to listen to your first episode about Jeff Anderson. I've just started listening to Bethany Markowski a little bit this morning, but you know, there's a lot there. I want people to know about these stories and recognize that there are ways you can help as a listener, as a true crime consumer, whatever you want to call it. There are ways that you can help, and that's very important. So all those links will be in the show notes. Everybody, go listen to Missing in Hushtown. Go listen to Secrets Beyond the Sacramento River. And look forward to more updates, Jules, from you. I'll be looking forward to that. And if there's any big updates, anything we need to follow up on, I'm happy to have you back on here.
Thank you. I hope that we'll be able to come back with good news and moving things forward. I think if we all work together, we can totally do it. We can get loud.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope that as well. Well, thank you everybody so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, be sure to let me know. Like Jules said, if you have any theories, any thoughts, anything that you can offer, you can email her. If you're watching on YouTube, you can also drop it in a comment or like send me a DM. I'll make sure it gets to Jules. And as always, you all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe. And I will talk to you next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast, is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. This show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Assistant editor is Charlie Leopold. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. All music used in this episode is from Pixabay. If you like the show, be sure to share it with others and leave a 5-star rating and review. Contact, support, and merch links can be found in the episode description. To unlock early ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content, join the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Listener stories, topic requests, and business inquiries can be submitted to perplexitymysterypodcast.com or emailed to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, stay curious.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games as all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.